The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Quite a few headlines. Typhoon hitting Japan over the night. 9 people, either killed or injured. I didn't get all the statistics on that. We've got a Trumpet article going up on that, though, later on today. Quite a lot yesterday in the United States with the Supreme Court nominee hearing. Brett Kavanaugh. We'll come to that more here in just a second. There's also a few other news items, just an update on what we've been talking about or discussing with respect to Germany and the rise of the far-right parties and just all of the general discontent right across the nation because of the ongoing controversial migrant or immigrant policies from Ms. Merkel's government. We'll look at that. And later on in this show, we're going to get into the subject, any way that you can cover the subject of offensive warfare, that wonderful chapter that is later on in the Overcomer booklet. I guess it's the last chapter. But we're going to look at Ulysses S. Grant and just the approach that he took in sweeping through the South and bringing an end to the worst war in American history, at least the worst in terms of casualties. So we'll come to that later on in the program as well. And speaking of the Civil War, I just thought I would, I'm not a Civil War buff by any means. And so in reading through this biography on Ulysses S. Grant, there's just lots of things that I'm frankly just learning for the first time. But it was fascinating to read last night about the surrender of the South and the circumstances revolving around the terms of the surrender there at Appomattox in Virginia. And basically, I thought it would be a good lead-in to just some of the chaos and division that you see developing in the United States today. I mean, the Civil War, as I said, 750,000 casualties, 750,000. I mean, that's more than all the other wars combined, or at least up to the Vietnam War. And it divided the country in a literal sense, 5 year, whatever it was, 4.5, 5 years of fighting and struggle. But what was fascinating in this this biography is that when they were coming right to the end and Grant had all of his forces. Basically, he had General Lee and his army, his dwindling army, on the run, and they were surrounded around this courthouse at Appomattox. And Grant had gotten the tag as sort of being this brutal butcher, some would say, because of the mass casualties on both sides. But just the willingness for Grant to push forward, even when so many Americans were dying. But they get right toward the end, and it was actually Grant who reached out to General Lee and said, look, certainly the events of this past week, the period where he was just on the run, certainly these events have proven to you that you can't win this war, that you're about to be defeated, and don't make us come in and just totally obliterate what's left of your army. Enough blood has already spilled on these fields of Virginia, well, all over the South. So he writes up this letter. This is April 7th in 1865. And he says to General Lee, the result of the last week must convince you of the hopelessness of further resistance on the part of the Army of Northern Virginia in this struggle. I feel that it is so and regard it as my duty to shift from myself the responsibility of any further effusion of blood by asking of you the surrender of that portion of the Confederate States Army known as the Army of Northern Virginia. He said very respectfully, yours, U.S. Grant lieutenant general. So that led to an exchange, a back and forth, of two or three more messages as General Lee was trying to determine what the terms of surrender would be. And Grant had gotten the reputation of demanding unconditional surrender with no strings attached. But here at the last, in an effort to just try to bring both sides together, knowing that the goal, the objective here, was to preserve the Union, as Lincoln had said over and over and over again. So at the last, I mean, he comes forward suggesting this this meeting at that Appomattox courthouse, or a house, I guess, adjacent to it. And at first, Lee wasn't sure about it. Then finally, he reached out, I guess, the next day or two, and it was on the 9th, April the 9th, that all of this happened. And General Lee went away from that just surprised at how benevolent, at how magnanimous General Grant was in these terms, in bringing this war to an end, in letting the Southerners, those that were in the army, Lee's army, to return to their farms and to rebuild their lives. A day or two after this was finalized, James Longstreet, he was one of General Lee's top generals, and as it happens, he was also a good friend of Ulysses Grant before the war. I think he was Grant's best man at his wedding, even. So a lot of these relationships go back to the Mexican War from the 1840s. But in any event, the hostilities come to an end. And then James Longstreet, he ventures into this home where the deal, where the terms were finalized. And this is what Ron Chernow had to say. He said, as soon as Grant saw his old pal, he sprang to his feet, shook his hand, offered him a cigar, and invited him to play Brag, the card game they had enjoyed before the war. As Longstreet told a reporter, he was bowled over by Grant's generous spirit. I thought to myself, how my heart swells. This is quoting Longstreet. How my heart swells out to so much, a magnanimous touch of humanity. He said, why do men fight who were born to be brothers? We were born to be brothers, and why are we fighting? I mean, this is a family affair. This is a family that's divided. It says, this is quoting Longstreet, his whole greeting and conduct toward us was as though nothing had ever happened to mar our pleasant relations. Well, a lot had happened, but now they had to move on. They had to come together, and they had to realize all over again that they were family. That's what nations are, families grown large. That's what the United States is today. 12, 13 times bigger than it was back in 1865. It's just a much bigger family, and so much fighting and so much division. What will it take to bring the family together again? Yesterday, I mean, what a spectacle. What a spectacle. You have Brett Kavanaugh. He's nominated for the Supreme Court. And the Democrats come in, and as reports have shown, they had it all planned over the weekend, Labor Day weekend. Chuck Schumer leading the way in a phone conference, saying, first of all, that maybe we should just stage a protest and get up and walk out. Well, they decide against that, and instead they determine to just disrupt the hearing in every way possible. I think it was eight seconds in, when Chairman Grassley started his opening statement, that you started to hear from all of these senators interrupting him right and left. I think there were something like 41 interruptions in the first hour. And of course, those Democrat senators, they were right in cahoots with the protesters in the back of the room as well. 70 people, I believe, were arrested. And there was Kavanaugh trying to ignore it. His wife having to remove the two daughters that were there, the little girls that were there to witness the hearings. But it was too contentious for them. And it's on display for the whole world to see, sadly. What a shame. This sort of thing. That's not unusual. I mean, this has been going on. This has been going on since the Robert Bork nomination from back in 1987. Ben Sasse pointed this out in his statement yesterday in the same hearing. This is clip number three.
Really, the reason these hearings don't work is not because of Donald Trump. It's not because of anything the last 20 months. These confirmation hearings haven't worked for 31 years in America. People are going to pretend that Americans have no historical memory, and supposedly there haven't been screaming protesters saying women are going to die at every hearing for decades. But this has been happening since Robert Bork.
Robert Bork, as we've written about before, America under attack. Edward Kennedy leading the charge back in 1987. Against Robert Bork, we've played this clip for you before, but this is what Edward Kennedy, the senator, the former senator, the late senator, this is what he said in Congress back in 1987, clip four.
Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids, and school children could not be taught about evolution. Writers and artists would be censured at the whim of government.
And of course, all of that, as Bork later said, all of those statements, just lies. Nothing in that statement by Senator Kennedy was accurate. But they had to do it. It was all politics. And as we've pointed out before, I mean, a lot changed when Herbert Armstrong died in 1986. And then you see what happened with the Bork nomination in 87 and the way that it's gone these past 30 years. And then yesterday, this childish circus. I mean, they had to remove the actual children while the children on the panel argued and shouted each other down. This is the way it is in the United States today. It wasn't always that way. You go back before 1987, and it was a lot more civil. I mean, that's what's amazing about this, too, is so many people that are just disruptive and obstructing, they go on and on about the president and how uncivil he is. But this is just the status quo today, or this is the standard fare that you see coming out from Washington. What will it take to bring the United States together again? Well, you can look back at some of that history in 1865, and even though there were a lot of difficulties ahead going forward for General Grant, for Abraham Lincoln, who was assassinated soon after those terms were agreed upon, lots of troubles, lots of obstacles that they still had to face, but you can look at this example with General Grant and see, and begin to see what it is it's going to take. Of course, it's going to take God, ultimately. It's going to take God and his attitude and his nature. This is from Ron Chernow's book. He's quoting from the New York Times. It says, in summarizing his salient qualities, the New York Times foresaw that in future generations, if a great soldier is indomitable in purpose and exhaustless in courage, endurance, and equanimity, if he is free from vanity and pettiness, if he is unpretentious, truthful, frank, constant, generous to friends, magnanimous to foes, and patriotic to the core, of him it will be said, he is like Grant. He's like Ulysses Grant. Magnanimous, as it says there, to foes, generous to friends, unpretentious, free from vanity and pettiness. We could certainly use a lot more of that. in the political arena today in the United States. You know, right before the two sides came together there at Appomattox and the South surrendered, Richmond was overrun, and a lot of Southerners were fleeing the city. This was the capital of the Southern states. I mean, this was a huge victory. This immediately preceded the downfall of that army of Northern Virginia. And all these Northerners, they wanted to see it for themselves, to see Virginia, to celebrate the South's demise. And when Grant got back to, near to where his army was headquartered, not that far from Richmond, his wife, Julia, she said, "Oh, you've got to go to Richmond. Let's go see Richmond right now." And of course, everyone knew who Grant was, and he told his wife that he wasn't going to do it. He wasn't interested in that. In fact, he said to her, "Don't say another word on this subject. I would not distress these people. They're feeling their defeat bitterly. And you would not add to it by witnessing their despair, would you?" Chernow says of Grant, "It was the observation of a man who had known terrible shame in his own life and understood the extreme need for self-respect at moments of failure." He had gone through a lot in his own life. I mean, he was really a failure in civilian life. Rescued from obscurity by this great civil war in so many ways. But he knew all about shame and failure. And so he didn't want to rub it in. He wanted to see the family to come together, like Longstreet brought out. Why do men fight who were born to be brothers? Why do they fight when they're family? Well, what does it say about family in 2 Timothy 3? It says families are, they're going to be divided. There's not even going to be a natural affection for one another. You look at the American family today, so much animus, contention, strife, exactly as is prophesied. And what will it take to bring us together again? Will it take another civil war? Think of the prophecies in Ezekiel 4 and 5. Think about what's coming upon our peoples. If they only knew. I mean, go back to this history and appreciate the sacrifice that went on before. And be sobered by these prophecies of God, given what's coming. You would think more people would be working to help one another and to find common ground. As it is, we're just drawing a line in the sand, preparing for battle. 44 interjections in the first hour of the hearing. One every minute or every minute and a half. Disruption. Obstruction. Chuck Schumer, the one who organized the dissent, he was heard on tape just over the weekend saying that the sooner the better. He was asked about the impeachment of Donald Trump. The sooner we do it, the better. That's the target. That's who he's going after. That's who the Democrats want to take down. No unity, no togetherness. It's not a family affair. Everyone's separated into their own tribe, fighting. Internal division, warfare, civil war. Some good lessons to take away from the Civil War of the 1860s. This piece from Reuters, by the way, just to follow on from what we've been saying or following on the protests in Germany, the far-right party, the Alternative for Deutschland, or the AfD party, It says here that it's overtaken the center-left Social Democrats. That's according to a poll yesterday. An INSA opinion poll on Tuesday put the AFD up half a percentage point to 17%, with the SPD, who share power with Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservatives, slipping by the same amount to 16%. So the SPD, they're moving down, and the AFD, they're moving up 17%. This is something to keep our eyes on. The rise of the right in Germany. Again, I can't mention it enough, that article in December of 2015 by Brad McDonald and Richard Palmer, where they ask, what's going to happen when the ordinary Germans wake up to what's happening? Well, we're seeing it happen. It's playing out right now. Another headline here about teen suicide, the teen suicide rate in England, here in England, in Wales. It's risen 67% since 2010. I mean, just in the last 7-8 years. And then you just see all these programs, some of them even about teen suicide. That popular one that we talked about a couple months ago, I think it was, either on Netflix or Amazon, I can't remember. But here they are just glorifying teen suicide. And teenagers are carrying it out. They're acting it out in real life. 67%. Up 67% in the last 8 years. What is happening to our families? Speaking of family and division and strife, what is happening to the conventional family right here in our own nations? This last bit here, I think it'll tie in well with what we discuss in the next segment about offensive warfare. Taking action in this battle that we're in. I mean, this has to do more with physical inactivity and the effect it has on our overall health. This one from France 24, it says more than 1.4 billion adults are putting themselves at heightened risk of deadly diseases by not getting enough exercise. And then over at CNN, it says around the globe, about 1 in 3 women and nearly 1 in 4 men does not exercise enough to avoid common diseases. My wife's been getting into this in her nutrition class here at the college, where, as it used to be, you had all these communicable diseases, and they would spread fast, and the lifespan wasn't as long as it is today. But then you look at the quality of life today and the diseases that we bring on ourselves because of the way that we live, the lifestyle that we have, the diets that we have. Well, it goes on and talks about how the wealthier countries of the world, they're moving more and more in the direction of sedentary occupations, sedentary recreational activities, just inactivity right across the board. It says declines in physical activity are inevitable as countries prosper and use of technology increases. Our cities, neighborhoods, schools, workplaces, entertainment venues, and transportation systems all have been designed to promote physical inactivity. Everything promotes it. It's all push button. Travel is easy and convenient. Well, it's not always, I guess, easy, but there's not a lot of activity associated with it. It says, finally, Guthold, that's one of the experts, I guess, cited in this piece, said that the people who are completely inactive can begin with a little exercise and then build up their weekly exercise time. It quotes her as saying, any activity is better than none, and more activity will provide greater health benefits. It's often easier to be active in a group with family or friends. Well, in the next segment, we'll talk about the activity needed to do God's work, the spiritual action that we have to take to serve and obey God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any and all comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
When President Abraham Lincoln appointed George Meade to head up the Army of the Potomac, he gave him these clear instructions. He said, find and fight the enemy. And when he gave those instructions, of course, there were quite a few people in Washington, D.C. that were pretty concerned because rebel forces had actually crossed into the North. They were roaming through Pennsylvania, looking for territory that they could capture. I mean, outnumbered population-wise, 5-1. And here General Lee's army seemed unbeatable. And so President Lincoln said, look, you've got to find that army and defeat that army. Well, after a number of weeks of playing cat and mouse, these two sides finally did converge on the little town of Gettysburg in early July 1863, and what followed was the bloodiest battle of modern warfare up to that time, worst ever. The Union Army lost 23,000 men, and the rebel army, 28,000. It's devastating for both sides, but all the more so for the rebel forces. General Lee ordered a retreat on July 4th of that year, 1863. And that happened to be the same day, by the way, that Ulysses Grant was leading the North to a momentous victory in Vicksburg, Mississippi. In any event, Lincoln, he immediately sends out this message to General Meade, and he says, if you could just complete the work so gloriously prosecuted thus far by the literal or substantial destruction of Lee's army, the rebellion would be over. If you could just destroy the rebel army, this is over. They're finished. But Meade, as I think most of you know, he didn't do that. He was satisfied with just chasing the rebels out of the North. He was just happy to have a victory. So the rebel forces crossed the Potomac, and they lived to fight another day. And the war, the great Civil War, it raged on for another 2 years, two more years of bloodshed. An effusion of blood, as Grant sent in that note to General Lee. After Gettysburg, General Meade, he wrote to congratulate his troops. He said, an enemy superior in numbers and flushed with the pride of a successful invasion, attempted to overcome and destroy this army. Utterly baffled and defeated, he is now withdrawn from the contest. The commanding general looks to the army for greater efforts to drive from our soil every vestige of the presence of the invader. And Abraham Lincoln, after reading that congratulatory note by General Meade, he said, "Drive the invaders from our soil? Is that all? Is that all he intends to do? To just drive them out of Pennsylvania? To drive them out of the North? The objective is Lee's army. Otherwise, this war is going to rage on. We've got to go after the army." Lincoln later wrote in a letter to Meade, he said, "Lee retreated, and you did not, as it seemed to me, pressingly pursue him. I do not believe you appreciate the magnitude of the misfortune involved in Lee's escape. He was within your easy grasp, and to have closed upon him would, in connection with our other late successes, have ended the war. Your golden opportunity is gone. I am distressed immeasurably because of it." Well, Lincoln later decided not to send that letter of rebuke. He realized that Meade didn't really want the command of the army in the first place, and he did, in fact, bring a victory at Gettysburg. But he did not utterly defeat the enemy. If only he would have continued going forward, if only he would have continued going after the army, Lee's army. There's a valuable lesson in this history for us. God's army. God's called upon us to rule with Jesus Christ. And he says those positions of rule, they're going to be made available to those who overcome and conquer. Revelation 2:26 talks about the overcomers. Those who keep God's works unto the end, they're going to be given power over the nations. Same with Revelation 3:21. "To him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne." To overcome is to conquer. To overcome is to go after the enemy, to go after the enemy army, and to conquer that enemy. We can't be satisfied with just pushing the enemy out of Pennsylvania, let's say. All through the Bible, you see many military and sports analogies about victory. Fighting the good fight of faith, Paul said, laying hold on eternal life, striving to enter in at the straight gate, Jesus wrote or said. Paul said we need to mortify or to crucify the deeds of the body. He also talked about running in a race or entering into a boxing match, where we're not beating the air, but we're keeping our bodies in subjection so that we don't end up being a castaway, so that we don't end up being a runaway, a failure. Listen to what Herbert Armstrong said back, I think this was in 1983. Here's clip 5.
"You see, we have something to do about it. Just having the Holy Spirit doesn't make you into a god. It doesn't give you the character of God. The character of God requires your action, your effort, your drive, if you please, initiative. You've got to work at it. You have to be led by the Holy Spirit."
That's Herbert Armstrong speaking back in 1983. About how that this way of life, this support for God's work, this building of divine character, it does take action and effort and drive, initiative on our part. overcome and conquer. Notice what it says in James chapter 4. James 4 and verse 7, it says, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. That's what we want. We want the devil and his army in retreat. We want to take a stand against Satan the devil and his army. Resist, oppose. I mean, here in the United States, as I was saying in the first segment, we're fighting with ourselves. We're fighting with our family. When we should be working together to fight against the devil and his influence. Is this lesson from the Civil War, from Grant's leadership, or a lack of offensive-minded work and effort on the part of General Meade? In our war, in our spiritual war, we've got to be gaining ground. We can't be gaining a step and then falling back a couple steps in full retreat. Of course, the way to do this, as verse 8 brings out, is to draw near to God, and he'll draw near to you. This is action. This is offensive warfare. This is how we go on the offensive in fighting for God. Draw near to God, and he'll draw near to you. Submit yourselves to God, and then resist, fight, oppose the devil, and he'll flee. Satan will actually retreat. That's what we want. That's what we want. We can't be satisfied with just pushing him out of our room or this house or this territory. We've got to go after him on the offensive. My father, in that chapter, the Overcomer book, he talks about how that the offensive is three or four times more difficult. It's three or four times as hard as passively enduring from day to day. That's quoting from Winston Churchill. Churchill said, it therefore requires all possible help in early stages. Nothing is easier than to smother it in the cradle. It's so much easier to relax. It's so much easier. Well, if Richmond's been overrun, let's just go and enjoy a stroll through Richmond and see what this victory brought us. Grant experienced that mindset in the West when he was fighting in Tennessee and Mississippi. His boys would have a small victory, and as soon as they'd get that, they'd relax. Or they'd want to go into the camp and raid it or loot it. And take all that the enemy left behind instead of going after the enemy, chasing the enemy down. There was one case, I remember, I forget the name of the camp or the battle. But the North, Grant's forces, pushed them out and then overtook this southern rebel camp. And the rebel forces, after they gathered themselves a few miles off, they returned and then put the North in retreat. And Grant said they made their mistake by relaxing, by settling, by getting too carried away with small victories, and not advancing and not going forward. It's three or four times harder, Churchill said. But that's the only way to obtain the victory. My father said in the booklet, if going on the offensive is three or four times harder, you need to be wholehearted, or you're going to get out on the battlefield and begin to hesitate, and you're going to get slaughtered physically and spiritually. See, there are those, as there are today, critics, even critics of General Grant, who say, well, he was a butcher, well, he sacrificed so many lives in going on the offensive the way that he did. Well, how many lives were sacrificed by those who relaxed, by those who wouldn't go after the enemy, by those who were just satisfied with pushing the rebel forces out of Pennsylvania? How many more years did this conflict have to go on and on and on? We've talked recently about the approach that the West took when Hitler was on the march, very nearly waiting until it was too late before they acted. And then once they finally had to act, look at how many lives were sacrificed because of a failure to act and to go on the offensive in 1936 or 1937 or 8 or 9. Well, they finally had to in 1939. My father wrote in the Overcomer book, this is from the offensive warfare chapter. He said, near the end of the Civil War, Lincoln was finally able to get a man who would fight, General Grant. Lincoln had gone through so many unsuccessful generals. Whenever these men suffered defeat, they always had excuses. Lincoln came to the point where he said, don't give me excuses, give me victories. The nation's about to fall apart. I mean, you've got to go out and get a victory here. It's not enough. It's not enough to see the rebel forces leave your territory if that force is still in existence. It's going to come back on you. It's going to come back on us. Well, finally in 1864, he found a general who would fight. As Chernow says in his book, Grant was the antithesis of everything Lincoln had deplored in his predecessors, as eager to fight as they were reluctant, as self-reliant as they were dependent, as uncomplaining as they were petulant. Grant did not badger or connive for more troops or scapegoat others. There would be no more grumbling from Lincoln about dilatory generals as Grant converted the Union Army into a scene of ceaseless activity. With his zest for combat, Grant was itching for a fight. He took over the Army of the Potomac, and it became a scene of ceaseless activity. What an inspiration! What an image! What a difference! The book says Ulysses S. Grant was a man of action par excellence, from whom idleness remained an enemy. You can find similar statements made about Churchill. These men understood that idleness and inaction in battle, that's a killer. Looking at the big picture, looking at the long term, if you're inactive in battle, if you're idle in battle, that leads to a lot of casualties, a lot more than there would be if you take the offensive. It says, not content merely to hold conquered territory or retreat into summer quarters, he meditated fresh schemes for further campaigns. As soon as he would get one victory, he'd start thinking about two or three more victories he could get. I don't want to stroll through Richmond. For one, I don't want to rub it into their face. But look, the objective here is to kill the army. The objective here is to get an unconditional surrender. It's not to gloat. It says, for Grant, the important thing was the constant, inexorable push southward. There's another statement in Chernow's book where he says, Grant had a tenacious and relentless sense of forward motion. Forward motion. He was relentless with that approach. He was tenacious. He led a constant, inexorable push southward. And you know what it resulted in? Lee's army, which was just running right through the north, won victory after another. As soon as Grant showed up, Lee was on the defensive. The whole tone of the Civil War changed. Ephesians 4:27 says, neither give place to the devil. Don't give him any place near you, around you, down the road from you. Don't give him a base of operations. Put him in retreat. Submit to God and resist the devil, and he'll flee. That's the objective in this battle. We've got to have Satan the devil fleeing from us. Now, we don't want to underestimate our enemy by any means. But at the same time, we don't want to overestimate his power either, because next to God, I mean, the devil is no match from God for God, rather. And if we submit to God, here again, what does the Bible say? It's God's power. It's God's power that will send Satan fleeing. Now, in recent months, we've heard so much, those of us in the church, about preparing to rule, about about becoming more studious, furthering our education, looking after our health. I've been talking to the students about getting more rest. I mentioned the nutrition class that my wife has been going through. Obviously, we want our students, but all of us in God's church, to be developing our talents, to go forward, to take the initiative, to be ambitious for God. The Bible says, be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. That's the key to obtaining victories. It's replacing those wrong thoughts, those wrong habits, those wrong activities with good ones, overpowering the evil with the good. I mean, that means we have to do something with this knowledge. We've got to be doers of the word. We can't just look on thinking we're an innocent bystander if we're just on the sidelines. We've got to go forward. We've got to make progress step by step. Set your affection on the things of God. You decide. God intended for our thoughts to govern our actions. He's not going to force us into his kingdom. We have to choose it. We have to choose it and go after it. If we just fall back into retreat or even the middle ground, thinking again, we're an innocent bystander, we're just going to drift. We're going to drift aimlessly along. And that's the direction Satan wants us to go in. Grant's fighting style, to go forward, nonstop action, that was his approach. Tenacious and relentless forward motion. That put some kind of pressure, unceasing pressure, on Robert E. Lee and the rebel forces. After Grant came on board, Lee never invaded the North again. It's pretty amazing, some of this history. When Grant was about to begin his campaign into Virginia to chase Lee back to Richmond, there was a reporter who asked General Grant, is there anything you want for us to relay to the leadership in Washington? And Grant said to this reporter, if you see the president, tell him from me that whatever happens, there will be no turning back. There will be no retreat. There will be no compromise. When Lincoln received word from a reporter about what Grant had said, he squeezed that reporter and kissed him on the head. He was so happy to hear that he had a general who would go forward. Relentless activity, relentless motion, tenacious. It says, by steadily pushing Lee 80 miles south, he had robbed him of mobility and prevented him from assuming the offensive. Grant now controlled the direction of the contest. And if he lost individual battles, he was winning the war. I mean, there were some bloody battles in Virginia. Horrific scenes. Even some few losses. But he was winning the war. It says in this biography, unlike other Union generals who freely invented excuses for inaction, the restless Grant always scanned the horizon to fight. He told his wife, what I want is to advance. What I want is to advance. I want to move forward. I want to go forward. I want to make progress. Lincoln said about Grant later on, the only evidence you have that he's in any place is that he makes things get. He makes things move. Wherever he is, things move, the president said. I mean, his presence socially, it was so understated, he could come into a room and you might not even notice he was there, but put him on the battlefield. And that's a different story. That's a different story altogether. 1 Peter 5, very similar to James 4, it says in verse 6, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you." Humble yourself under God's mighty hand. And then verse 8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour." I mean, that's our enemy. If we're not making him flee with God's mighty hand, he's going to be walking about seeking whom he can pick off, whom he can devour. God says in verse 9, whom resist steadfast in the faith. You've got to resist against him. You've got to fight against him. When Grant came on board with the Army of the Potomac, he right from the start, he had to change this way that the Northern Army viewed General Robert E. Lee, this mystique. It was almost like they worshipped him more than they worshipped their own commanders. They thought he was unbeatable. So that's why they were happy to just push him out of Pennsylvania. Well, Grant brought a different attitude. Grant said, I'm tired of you worrying about what Robert E. Lee's next move will be. I want you thinking about my next move. I want you to think about where we're going, how that we're going after that force. We're going to put him in retreat. And he did, 80 miles of backpedaling. And the rebel forces were entrenched around Richmond, at least for a time. Until finally, the North was able to break through after some victories elsewhere with General Sherman's march and some other things. But finally, in early 1865, almost 2 years on from Gettysburg, well, there was some smaller losses along the way, like I said. But he was winning the war. In fact, after one setback for Grant's forces, one of Robert E. Lee's assistants came in and told him that Grant was retreating. And General Lee said, "You are mistaken, quite mistaken. Grant is not retreating. He's not a retreating man. He is not that kind of man. He advances. He goes forward." How would any of us like that to be said? Or what would we think about that if that was our enemy's assessment at the end of this war? One thing about him, he doesn't retreat. He doesn't go forward. There's other instances in the book when both sides, North and South, they just ground to a halt. There was a standstill. They both felt defeated. They both were exhausted. They both suffered a lot of casualties. And at those moments, what do you suppose the approach is that Grant took? Action. Action. Even when you're down and out, think of the point about perseverance in the seven laws of success. Grant said after things went bad at Fort Donelson, he said, "The one who attacks first now will be victorious." Okay, so we've both suffered setbacks here. We've got to dig deep. We've got to keep moving forward. We can't be discouraged. We've got to persevere. The first one to act. There's another case after there were thousands of casualties during the first day of fighting at the Battle of Shiloh. Another brutal battle down in Mississippi. Or maybe it was just South Tennessee. I forget. But Grant told General Sherman that when both sides seemed defeated in battle, the first to assume the offensive would surely win. When both sides seem defeated, who's going to be the first one to act? Who's going to be the first one to go on the offensive? It's three or four times harder, as my father brings out in the booklet. But this is the only sure path to victory. And in this war that we're in, victory is the objective. Victory is our battle cry. Victory is what we go after. Remember this history from the Civil War and from World War II. Remember the relentless forward motion that it's going to take for us to overcome and to conquer, for us to win in this war that we're in, so that we can qualify to rule right along Jesus Christ in God's soon coming kingdom. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any and all comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.